The next item on the program is medical treatment and ethics. We have two people to present this. Dan Brock is the... Somebody out there in the hall, knock whoever that is in the head so we can get some quiet in here, will you? Dan Brock is the Francis Glessner Lee Professor of Medical Ethics in the Department of Social Medicine and the Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the Harvard Medical School. He is also the Director of the Harvard University Program in Ethics and Health. Professor Brock has written more than 150 articles on bioethics and on moral and political philosophy, which have appeared in books and peer-reviewed journals. He's appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, the magazine Science, Hastings Center Report, and Philosophy and Public Affairs and Ethics. Adrian Ash is the Edward and Robin Milstein Professor of Bioethics and Director of the Center for Ethics at Yeshiva University, where she also holds appointments at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and the Wurzweiler School of Social Work. She has written numerous articles and book chapters and is the co-editor of Prenatal Testing and Disability Rights and the Double-Edged Helix, Social Work Implications of Genetics in a Diverse Society. We'll start with Professor Brock. Here is Dan Brock.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation. I suspect Adrian is responsible for that. We've discussed these issues together for some years now. A warning, many of you will find at least a part of what I want to argue this morning to be quite controversial and probably not something you want to accept, but nevertheless, you're going to hear it, and you can feel perfectly free to reject whatever part of it you like, from all to any subset. I'm going to speak about disability generally. I've used blindness in a number of the papers I've written in this area as an example, but really I have no special focus on blindness or special expertise with regard to blindness. The focus of the work I've done on this has been broader, and it's focused on genetically transmitted disabilities, and in particular those that we have developed tests for. I'm going to argue for the compatibility of two different theses, which many people, I think, take to be incompatible or inconsistent. The first thesis, and this is the one that will be controversial with many of you, maybe all of you, is that we have good reason to try to prevent the birth of seriously disabled persons. This position, as I say, has been controversial in the disability community and criticized by many in it. And I'm going to try to respond to the critique of that position. The second position is that disability has no effect on persons' existing persons' moral status. The equal worth of all persons applies just as much to anyone with any kind of disability as it does to anyone without one. And in fact, I'm going to argue, and this ties up in some ways with the presentation I heard this morning about the legal issues, because that's where the sort of rubber hits the road for the second thesis. The second thesis is that, in fact, on very common views of justice, both in sort of political philosophy, but also in simply Americans' political views. On very common views of justice, disability generates specific claims to social resources that need not be claims based on it's most cost effective to do this. So I'm going to argue for both of those theses, and I'll do them one by one. The first, as I say, is the prevention of the birth of persons with serious disabilities. And this is the more controversial, obviously. There's significant public support, I think, for this. One finds it in a lot of research on the genetic bases of disease. One finds it in the development of tests for genetically transmitted disease. One finds it in health insurance coverage of genetic testing when there are tests for particular disabling conditions. One finds it in the use of either preconception or postconception genetic testing for a variety of disabling conditions. And one finds it in physicians and potential parents' support of the use of genetic testing when they, at least when they are at serious risk of transmitting a particular disease. Also, I think it's uncontroversial among certainly most people that serious disabilities, that it's a good thing to prevent them if we can. Becoming seriously disabled is widely considered a misfortune, and public policy will use coercion with regard to parents to ensure that they get health care that would prevent their child from becoming disabled or, in some cases, restoring a particular function. The child abuse and neglect laws basically can be applied in that context. So the question is, if it's relatively uncontroversial about trying to prevent serious disabilities in people that already exist, then the question is, why not prevent them in persons who will be born? And when there's a genetic cause for a particular disabling condition, but no therapy for that condition, or no effective therapy for it, then what the only way you can do this is to prevent the birth of the disabled person or the person who would become disabled. You can do that with preconception testing in many cases and see whether people are at risk for passing on a particular disability. You can do it with postconception testing and pregnancy termination. Pregnancy termination raises obviously a different an additional issue I'll say something about in a moment, but because one could certainly object just to abortion. So let me take up some of the arguments that have come out of mostly what I would broadly call the disability community against the position that we have good reason to try to prevent the birth of persons who will have serious disabilities. And this will be pretty familiar stuff to many of you. One, probably the most common, is just to argue that it's a mistake to assume the defect is in the person. Rather, it's in an inhospitable environment. And the stuff on the various legal challenges this morning is an attempt to make the environment more hospitable, is one way of thinking about it. It certainly is the case. The social environment has largely been designed for, scare quotes, normal functioning persons. Legislation like the ADA has made us aware over the last, I guess now, two decades, how much environmental change can reduce the disadvantage of physical or mental impairments. And many such changes are, in my view, required by any plausible account of social justice. What I will assume, however, is that serious disabilities will still have residual disadvantages to the persons who have them, even when the environment has been changed in ways that justice would require us to change it. The disadvantage would be much less than it is now when we haven't made all those changes, but nevertheless, I believe there will be some residual disadvantage in the case of serious disabilities. There's a lot of truth to the inhospitable environment claim. It just doesn't get rid of all of the disadvantage, in my view. It's also claimed that the lives of many disabled persons are no worse than those of non-disabled persons. That's clearly true. It's not controversial. There are a lot of studies that show that persons without disabilities think that it would be worse to have a particular disability than the persons who do have that disability find it to be. And there are a lot of studies that show that gap between the non-disabled evaluation of how bad a disability would be in their life and how bad it is from the people who have it. And a big part of the reason for that is a variety in non-disabled persons of stereotypes, prejudices, false beliefs about what it's like to be disabled and how it would affect their life. It's also connected to the issue of adaptation or adjustment. Now, so it certainly is the case that many, and probably you are all good examples, or many of you are good examples of it, many disabled persons have just as good or better lives than the average non-disabled persons. Nevertheless, at the point at which one is confronting a serious risk of a genetically transmitted disease, for the entire class of persons with a serious genetic disability, I do want to argue that it is and will be a significant disadvantage to have it. Decisions need to be made about prevention when one's talking about preventing the birth of persons with serious disabilities. Decisions need to be made there when one only knows that the person, because of a genetic test, is going to be a member of a class of persons with a particular genetic condition. Some members of that class will end up having much better lives than persons without disability, but on balance for the class, I want to suggest it remains a disadvantage. If it wasn't a disadvantage, we wouldn't think of it as a disability. We would think of it as a differently able person, or persons, if it's not a disadvantage at all, but even a benefit, people who have advantages that non-disabled persons don't. So I think at the point at which one is making decisions in the reproductive context, the expected effect of a significant disability on the quality of life of a person who will have it is negative. So it's not a mistake, I think, to focus only on the disability if that's all you know about what this person, how this person will be different than other persons. Now, sometimes it's claimed that preventing disabilities is just a case of misplaced perfectionism. After all, everyone's life has significant handicaps and struggles to overcome. I started working on these issues before I had a disability. Now I have MS, and so now I qualify, I guess. And that has been a hardship to be overcome and to be dealt with. And so one might say we just have to learn to endure and overcome various difficulties and disabilities in life. I think this is certainly true. I wouldn't want to challenge that claim at all, but I think it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to prevent these hardships when we can do so. This needn't be a desire for a perfect baby. It may be a desire only to remove or prevent a disadvantage when we can do so. Now, in talking with Adrian and many others in the disability community, the distinction is often made between preventing people from becoming disabled, and that's what I earlier said I think is not very controversial, as opposed to preventing the existence of disabled people. And it's the latter that I've been talking about. That's what's controversial. And the argument is that what it does is conflate persons with their disabilities. You just see them only, you see only their disability. You don't see all the other things true of them. And it seems to imply to many people judgments, for example, that you think it would have been better suppose I have disability X, then you say, well, that implies that it would have been better if I'd never been born. And if that is the message, of course, that's understandably an offensive controversial message. I think it isn't the message, but nevertheless, if that is the message, one can certainly understand why anyone would be opposed to the kind of view I'm talking about. The vast majority of disabled persons have lives that are well worth living, lives that they enjoy and value. And so the question arises, for whose sake would you be preventing those persons from earlier coming into existence, for the preventing the birth of disabled persons? Now, I'm going to say for whose sake in a minute, but I want to take a side detour to abortion, because for many cases of selection, the genetic testing is done post-conception, not preconception. And then if you're going to act on it and prevent the birth of the disabled person, it's typically through pregnancy termination. I just want to suggest that abortion is simply a separate issue here. Some oppose genetic testing in the reproductive context because they oppose abortion, and that's what the genetic testing is often used and often for and often results in. But some opponents of genetic testing and selection don't oppose abortion. I think Adrian is actually, I think that's her view, unless she's changed it. But if the objection is to abortion, then it's not to creating or giving birth to disabled persons. It's to the way in which one does that, namely abortion. And the other reason the abortion issue is separate is that in any cases of preconception testing, of course, abortion isn't needed. People take other steps to avoid the birth of a seriously disabled person. So abortion is mixed up in this issue, but it is nevertheless a distinct issue. Now, I'm going to come back to if disabled persons have, as most do, nearly all do, valuable lives, lives that they value, worthwhile lives, then for whose sake is it that one is preventing them from being born? A case that has used in the philosophical literature that I'll give you quickly, you're going to hear it again, Adrian, sorry, apologies, but suppose a woman is told that if she gets pregnant now, her child will almost certainly be very seriously cognitively disabled. But if she simply waits 2 months, then there's every reason to believe that she'll have a normal functioning child. Suppose she doesn't wait and gives birth to the child, say, with a serious cognitive disability. I think most people, when I've presented this case, it's owed to Derek Parfit, but when I presented this case, say, well, it would be wrong for her not to wait, because if she waited, she would have a child without the serious cognitive disability. And but if she went ahead right now and got pregnant, she does have the child with a serious cognitive disability. So most people think her action would be wrong if she didn't wait to avoid having the child with a serious disability. But nevertheless, there's a sense in which her action doesn't harm her child when she doesn't wait. Why? Because the only way that child could exist is with that serious disability. If she waits 2 months, she has a different child. It's not as if she has the first child without the disability. So you ask, for whose sake is she waiting? It's certainly not for the sake of her disabled child, because in one sense, her disabled child gets a benefit, or at least isn't harmed, by being born with a worthwhile, though disabled, life. So if she doesn't harm that child, then it's not clear why she does anything wrong. And so I think this has been called the non-identity problem. I'm not sure why it got named that, but in any event, the non-identity problem in philosophical work. I think what the answer for whose sake should she wait is not for the sake of the disabled child she'll have if she doesn't wait, because that's that child's only chance at life. It's for the sake of there being less disadvantage, reduction in opportunity, and in some cases suffering in the world. And the way she serves that aim is to substitute one child, a child that won't be disabled, for the child that will be disabled, right? That's what she does when she waits and has a different child. Now, whether a couple's what reasons, all things considered, a couple might have to prevent the birth of a child with serious disability depends, I think, on a lot of factors in the particular case. How serious is the disability? Obviously, they range from seriousness. Even if one takes a particular condition like Down syndrome, that condition has a wide range of variation. So one issue is how serious is the disability? How likely is it that the parents can have a non-disabled child instead, so to speak, if they wait, in my earlier example? What are their attitudes towards abortion, if that would be necessary to prevent the birth? Can they give a disabled child the needed support that it may require? How important is it to them to have a biologically related child? What will the impact be on others, for example, other family members, of having the seriously disabled child? There's a whole bunch of factors that would be relevant in thinking about all things considered should they try to do what the woman does when she waits and have a non-disabled child instead. Now, one other thought about the goal of eliminating disabilities. Sometimes that goal is challenged on the grounds that it would reduce support for people with disabilities. If we eliminated 50% of the blindness in society, your organization would be smaller, and there would be fewer people that you would have to serve. Now, that would mean the disability movement would be smaller and probably less politically powerful, but of course the resources needed to serve this particular disability community would be less if the numbers were reduced. And there's also a related claim that has the same problem I'm going to point out in a moment. Would the world be a worse place without persons with disabilities in it? Now, let's suppose, for example, less diversity, less tolerance of difference, people won't learn to overcome obstacles as well, and so forth. Now, to some extent, I don't think we need disabilities in order to have to learn to overcome obstacles, because there are a lot of obstacles that have nothing to do with disabilities that fill up our lives. But suppose the answers to those two questions were yes, that is, the world would be a worse place without persons with disabilities in it, and disability movements would become less powerful, in particular politically, if the number of persons who were disabled seriously declined. Suppose that's the case. I still think it's a very problematic justification for not trying to reduce the birth of persons with serious disabilities. Let me try to give you an analogy. Should we forego smoking prevention if it would reduce support for lung cancer research and the treatment of lung cancer? Someone might say, yes, it would, just in the same way that the argument that I just gave you went with regard to disabilities. But most of us wouldn't think that was a very good argument for not trying to reduce smoking. In each case, what we would be doing is allowing a preventable condition, in the smoking example, smoking, to continue to exist because it has a benefit. Even though it harms the person who has the condition, it benefits others. It benefits the funds for cancer research. So that's what I have time for in terms of trying to think, to talk about some of the responses that have typically been made to the claim that there is good reason to try to prevent the birth of persons with serious disabilities. Now, what I want to turn to now is the other thesis that I said I think is fully compatible with what I've just been arguing, which is that persons who do exist with serious disabilities have serious claims on grounds of justice to various support services and resources. Okay, I can do it. little quicker. So there's basically, there's a very deep-seated moral principle or political principle in the political culture of our society, that we believe in some sense, in some form or another, of equality of opportunity. Disagreement about how to interpret this, people disagree about how does that play out with affirmative action programs and so forth, but nevertheless, some principle of that sort is widely accepted. So to take a different disability than the one present here, if the disability is problems with mobility, then access ramps and curb cuts and elevators and buses with, that can take wheelchairs and so forth. Virtually none of that existed when I was a kid, but it does exist now, and what it does is to give people access to participation in public life, in access to work, access to public facilities, access to cultural facilities, and so forth and so on. The ADA defines disability as any physical or mental condition that limits one or more major life activities of an individual. And so what equality of opportunity requires is, to the extent that we can, removing barriers to being able to participate in those major life activities. There may be limits in some cases as to how much we can do and whether we can remove them all, but we can certainly remove them to a great extent. Now, what's important here is that equality of opportunity is widely considered a requirement of social justice. It's a requirement to remove an unjustified disadvantage that people suffer. It's not simply a means for maximizing social welfare. If it was a means for maximizing social welfare, then every time we were thinking about doing something that was supposed to improve opportunity, we'd have to ask, is that the best use of the resources? Could we use them, say, for non-disabled persons, and it would be more cost-effective in terms of the benefits? But that's not... things that are required by equality of opportunity don't have to pass that cost-effectiveness test. And what that means is we don't compare access ramps to putting in access ramps to improving the stairs that people who are fully mobile can take. This doesn't mean the demands, the moral demands of equality of opportunity are unlimited, but it does mean that they generate a claim to services and resources that need not be cost-effective in comparison with other uses of those resources which don't serve that moral goal of equality of opportunity. Now, there's one other, I suspect, since I had 3 minutes, probably 3 minutes ago, one other, for some of you familiar with work in justice, Amartya Sen's work with capabilities is another way of getting at the additional claim. Sen uses a very simple example. Suppose someone with diabetes needs additional resources for insulin that someone without diabetes doesn't need in order to have the same capabilities and the same opportunities that the person without diabetes has. And so that special need generates an additional claim to have an equal capability to pursue one's life. So that, I'm sure, is a sign that I have used my last 3 minutes. So I'll sit down.
Adrian? Okay. Right this way. Right this way, right up there.
Thank you. Well, thank you. It's a wonderful to be at this symposium. I have been at this symposium as a happy attender, and now trying to get to present is daunting. And following Dan Brock's presentation, you all as attendees are coming into a long conversation one that Dan Brock and I have had, and that bioethics and I, as a member of the bioethics world, as well as the disability community, if you like, and member of NFB, have been having for about 27 years. So we're trying, both of us, to articulate in not very much time, very long and complicated conversations. And I'll try to do justice to my own view. In some ways, Dan's presentation is, it seems it's on the surface, I think, so nice and uncontroversial, like, why am I bothering? But I'll see if I can explain why I'm bothering. The discussion about preventing the births of people with disabilities, if what's being prevented is the births of the people rather than the existence of the disability, gives a kind of new meaning to the words of Jacobus ten Broek, who didn't know about bioethics necessarily when he wrote this, called The Right to Live in the World. His article was about mobility and access, broadly defined, to the goods of the world. And his argument was that people with disabilities, main group were people with traditional disabilities, blindness, deafness, mobility impairment, but he was not excluding people with cognitive, intellectual, affective disabilities. His point was people with disabilities were legitimate members of society. Dan Brock agrees with that. If we already exist, we're legitimate members of society and we're entitled to the social resources to help us fulfill life goals, life plans that we might have. Ten Brook's view is that, again, people with disabilities were legitimate members of society. Now, where Brock and I have disagreed, and where some of the arguments that he quotes or paraphrases are arguments that I've actually made. Some of them are not, are either arguments that I don't make and reject. But so I'm only going to describe the arguments that I have made in the past and still make about why I think that there is a difference between the moral requirement to prevent the births of people who will have disabilities if you can, and the moral requirement to give people with disabilities who already exist in the world social resources. So he's trying to say that you can have both those views and that they're compatible. I don't think they're compatible. I don't think it is morally required to bring to term fetuses with disabilities. I do think it is morally required to give people enough information about life with disabilities so women or couples can make decisions about what they want to do. So one of the big places that we have disagreed is in the notion of moral requirement. If Brock were saying, and if bioethics were saying genuinely, if mainstream bioethics were saying that it was genuinely a choice for women to make, either at the embryo selection stage, how many embryos are you going to implant and which embryos are you going to implant if you have in vitro fertilization and 2 or 6 or 8 embryos? Are you going to check to make sure that the only ones you implant are the ones without diagnosable disabilities? Or are you going to do pregnancy termination? My objection is the notion of selection. Now, this has made some people within the broad disability scholarship world oppose some of my views because I'm interested in not selecting the characteristics of offspring, period. That's what I'd like to see people do, is not select. If you want to be a parent, be a parent, and do a test if you want. Get information. If you want to select, go ahead and select based on the information you get. Have that information accurate about what life with disability really means, which it primarily is not, as given by genetic counselors and OBGYNs and midwives and a lot of mainstream bioethics, although not all. So get that information, make your decision. My own preference is that people who wish to undertake parenthood and that agree that they're prepared to be the parents of any child rather than a particular child with a particular set of characteristics. But what I want to... So my opposition is to the notion of selection. Some people within the disability world say it's really terrific, the lesbian deaf couple who wanted to select sperm to make sure that they had a child who would be genetically deaf, if they thought that was terrific. I mean, if you're going to be allowed to select against disability, I see no objection to selecting for, if that's what you want, but I think we should be challenging what some people have called the selective mentality. So that's one difference, the notion of the selective mentality that I think didn't come out so much in today's, in Dan's presentation today, but does come out in other things that, as far as I know, he still believes. Here's an example of a paragraph from Chance to Choice. Is this fair? Are you not repudiating the book?
No. I might attribute what you quote to the three other authors, but...
Well, I know that you aren't the primary author of this paragraph, but nonetheless, it's the conclusion of chapter two, if you want to know, Dan. Eugenics casts a shadow in large part because of the way in which it was pursued, ellipsis. These abuses, abuses referring to Nazi abuses, do not lend themselves to condemnation of the eugenicist's every thought and goal, any more than Nazi cost-benefit thinking condemns cost-benefit thinking. Though we agree with the need to be vigilant over any hint of a return of these abuses, our examination of the shadow of eugenics has focused on the less visible issues of morality and justice at its center. These pose questions and challenges as much as warnings and admonitions. Reprehensible as much of the eugenic program was, there is something unobjectionable and perhaps even morally required in the part of its motivation that sought to endow future generations with genes that might enable their lives to go better. We need not abandon this motivation if we can pursue it justly. Now, the problem I have with that paragraph...
I didn't write it, but I do agree with it.
I know you didn't write it, and I believed you agree with it. Okay. The problem I have with that, and I think it's evidenced in what you said today, is the equating of how life goes too much with genetic endowment and particular characteristics. Now, you've said people with disabilities can have lives as valuable and as worthy as people without. You've said that people with disabilities, on the whole, enjoy their lives. You've also said in a pretty blanket way that disability is a disadvantage. Now, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I think we're so far from having the hospitable world that one would like that we are not going to know for a really long time what's intrinsic to the disadvantages of impairment or disability itself. But I think the disadvantages that are imagined in your discussions and other people's discussions in bioethics are about what's often called the normal opportunity range. And that normal opportunity range, I think, focuses too much on the range and not about what we do with the opportunities we have. So the fact that some person with some disability, take blindness, won't enjoy Rembrandt paintings and is in itself not a reason not to live as a person who's blind. Now, you're not saying that, but you're saying that preventing blindness is on balance, or cystic fibrosis or muscular dystrophy or cognitive disability is on balance better because people should have the full complement of opportunities that species-typical human beings have. Well, I think we can value capacities and appreciate that some people have capacities others of us don't, without saying that not to have those capacities is so disvaluable that people shouldn't be born. And whether the lack of capacity that we're talking about is sight or mobility, or the lack of capacity is the capacity to do higher mathematics or play the violin. The conviction in bioethics that any one capacity of the set of species-typical capacities is so important for virtually any plan of life, I think, really misconstrues and conflates disability with the social environment. Now, you've tried, and other people have begun to try to say, okay, the social construction of disability is important, and if the environment were more hospitable, disability would be less of a disadvantage. But really, disability is always going to be some disadvantage. That's why we call it disability. That's what you've just said. Well, number one, I don't think we know how much of a disadvantage it will be. But even if we grant that it will be some disadvantage, what it means to do what you ask us to do in allocating healthcare resources to born persons with disabilities, which is to respect the moral worth and moral equality of individuals, I think needs to be done for the society, the woman, the couple, prenatally, preconception, pre-embryonically as well, to say it is as legitimate, as respectable to be a person with a disability and come into that world, and the society doesn't have to celebrate diversity. I'm not interested in signs that say disability is delightful or that glorify the identity aspects of having an impairment. I'm not in the camp that disability is totally identity defining. In fact, I think it's not so identity defining. It's one characteristic of any individual. And how much it affects one's identity has as much to do with the way the social and familial environment broadly defined treat that individual as any characteristic, as anything inherent in that individual. So if we want to respect the legitimacy of life with a disability, then I think that means respecting the decision of any particular woman and a partner, if she's making this decision with a partner, to bring to term a fetus or to implant an embryo without doing genetic tests, based on the notion that it's possible to lead a good life with a disability. And that if you want the kind of moral equality after birth, you need to give the same moral equality before birth. And I think that's important to the whole notion of respecting what it means to live as a person with a disability. And the problem that I have with the prenatal testing, pre-embryonic argument, or the embryonic argument, is that I think it fails to give the respect not to the sanctity of the embryo or fetus, but to the legitimacy of life with whatever characteristics one has. And to say that the level of well-being in society will be, to some extent, reduced by the costs of bringing to term people with these impairments who will need resources. I'm not interested in making sure there are more people with disabilities to have greater social movement power. I was once accused of that. But I am interested in making sure that people now and in the future see it as, if we want to see it as legitimate to be a person with a disability after we are born, then it has to be as legitimate to be born with a disability and to have women, couples, and the physicians and genetic counselors and midwives and bioethics elites who talk to them believe that that's equally legitimate. And I think that the prenatal testing arguments that you and others have made don't support that legitimacy and respectability. I know that you think that that can be done, but I'm not sure it's possible. Now, here's why I want to say two other things. I realize that it's almost time for the questions and answers and stones to be thrown. Polite stones, I'm sure.
I think you're safe. It's me who's in danger.
Well, no. I know of some people in the audience who don't share my views.
As much as he took 7 more minutes, you get that minute.
All right, thank you very much. I might not need them all, but the notion of disability as disadvantage, I think, is based on a kind of incorrect notion of what makes a life good or bad. At different times, you and others in bioethics have talked about how it's okay, the person born with a disability won't know what they've missed, but the person who loses capacity and acquires a disability will really know what they've missed, and they'll know how really bad it is. Now, I want to say that I think that's basically not really even true at the psychological level. If you, people who are disabled from birth are well aware of what they don't have. They're told every day. Sometimes they're told as a matter of description, just in case we miss the point. Sometimes they're told in tones of pity and condescension. People are surrounded by people enjoying paintings they don't see, music they don't hear, sports they don't play. So I think it's ludicrous to think that anyone born with a disability who is not full of sorrow and rage at her condition is simply denying the glories of the world that she doesn't know. It's also true that, I mean, an argument that's been made that people with disabilities who cope or adapt or adjust their expectations, and that's very nice, but in fact they have to lower their expectations of what life is, what's possible for their lives. I think that's just not actually how it works. An interesting point that I suppose could be used to support my bioethics opponents, as well as my own side in these debates, was made yesterday in a presentation about how the gap in perceptions of quality of life for people with and without disabilities, that there's a gap that's widening, according to some polling data. Now, interestingly, the polling data don't explain why that gap exists. But one hypothesis that's at least plausible, if we take a lot of other psychological theories about expectations and relative deprivation, is that the more that laws like the Americans with Disabilities Act exist, the easier it is for people with disabilities to envision a life that is full of opportunity and a society that is welcoming and a society that is going to be inclusive. And the frustrations that between what's imaginable and what exists are potentially the reasons for supposedly decreased views of the quality of life of people with disabilities, or the difference between the perceived quality of life of people with and without disabilities. Well, that's not a statement. It's not that cystic fibrosis or blindness got worse between 1990 and 2010. It's that what people could imagine about the potential of life in a more inclusive, rights-oriented world got greater. And then the gap between what's imaginable and what's happening is more frustrating. Well, that's an argument not necessarily for greater efforts at preventing the births of people with disabilities. It's an argument for reducing the inhospitableness of the environment. It's an argument for really trying to change the social construction of disability. And that's why I think that some of these, what may seem like arcane philosophical arguments about prenatal testing or about the allocation of healthcare resources, are related to the work that we do as either members of disability organizations, disability scholars more broadly, people in the legal field working to secure the rights and opportunities of people with disabilities. While I don't in general want to...
3 minutes.
Okay. While I don't want to give a lot of weight to what was known as the loss of support argument, fewer disabled people in society means less political power, what I do want to say instead is, if we want to support the notion that schools and buildings and workplaces and daycare programs and health services should be available to people with disabilities when they are born, when they come into the world, when they acquire disabilities in midlife or old age, I think it will be harder to make that case if we say, well, if we continue to say, it's really tragic that people with disabilities are born, we should prevent those births by preventing the births of those people, but now that they are born, let's do everything we can to make their lives as good as possible. That sentence doesn't work. I think a better sentence or a better formulation is, let's accept that people, and this relates to David Frilliger's point about the universalizing of humanity, let's accept that people in families and in societies have a whole range of characteristics, some of which they like a lot, some of which they don't. We don't have to adore our disabilities. We can think they're plenty more than a nuisance. We can think a lot of negative things about certain aspects of disability. But if it is legitimate to live as a person with a disability, then the society and the family and the elites of the world have to recognize that those are legitimate characteristics and deserving of those resources. Now, you would say that's true after birth. But I think in order to really make that case well, you need to be able to say it is fair for a woman to make the decision to bring to term or select the embryo or not select the embryo and take the chance that the child she wants to raise, the family she wants to create, will include a person with a disability. And that's where I'll stop. Thank you.
All right, if you'll step down to the right over here and get yourself a place to sit, they can find a microphone.
Oh, okay.
Undoubtedly, there will be questions for you.
We all have strong views about these things, I'm sure. Chris Danielson, you're called first.
Hold on, Chris.
There will be other questions, so get those microphones ready.
Thank you, Dr. Maurer. I do want to thank, did I kill the mic?
Go for it.
All right. I do want to thank both Dr. Ash, but also Dr. Brock for being here. As much as I disagree with him, I do have to admire his willingness to walk into a hostile crowd. I'm about to express some of that hostility, albeit as politely as I can. My comment before my question is that I do agree with Dr. Ash that as much as you would like them to be, Dr. Brock, your theses are incompatible. I am already told, I was told in an email once, that as a disabled person, I needed to accept the fact that I was going to be isolated to a certain extent from society and that I should not expect resources to be devoted to me. I think that view is only going to become more prevalent if society is told that I shouldn't have been born in the first place. I want you to flesh out your views, though, on, because the paragraph that Dr. Ash read from the book that you co-authored that struck me, the words that struck me were morally required. Now, it seems to me that what you are talking about is not choice and not, as you put it, the number of factors that somebody considering whether to have a disabled child might consider. You are actually saying that society should put pressure on such an individual not to have a disabled child. Now, you didn't go as far as saying legally we should require them not to, but what you're basically saying is that a person who is in that position is morally required not to have that child. Am I mischaracterizing your position, sir?
So, Dan or Dr. Brock or Professor Brock, however you like to be called.
That's fine.
Dan, go for it.
No, but I want to just flesh out the position. You're not mischaracterizing. Let me flesh it out slightly. I am not saying that any condition that we might think of as that might fall within the category of a disability is such that it provides good reasons or certainly moral obligations to prevent the birth of someone with that condition. Think about cases of already born children. There, I think prevention of serious disabilities is not very controversial. If I am a parent and I'm in a position to prevent a very serious cognitive disability that would come from, say, meningitis or some other medical condition, then I think as a society we think that the parents are required to get the medical care for their child to prevent that very serious disability. Not a disadvantage that I only don't have a pinky or something like that. Now, so the question then is, if we think it's required in the case of a person already born that disadvantage be prevented, if possible, then why is the prenatal or preconception case different?
And it can be different, at least in the respect that the prenatal case canon typically does involve abortion, and that just brings another issue in. But I don't think that's what we're talking about. So you're right that I think sometimes, just as with a born child, parents can have an obligation, a moral obligation, to prevent a very serious disability in that child. I do not think, and I agree with Adrian on this count, I do not think that that because the circumstances are so complex in any real case, I don't think it should be the business of the law to enforce this view, even if it became widely accepted that people morally ought to prevent very serious disabilities. I don't think it's the business of the law to do so. But you do basically characterize my view accurately.
Okay, now, Chris, I know you would like another chance, but only if there are no other questions.
Allison DeFranco.
Allison, you're first.
I would like to also thank both of you for being here. And actually, Adrian, I appreciate you reading out of Professor Brock's book, because it reminded me that we read that in Steve Taylor's disability studies class, and it was heavily debated. I did have a couple of questions, and they're very similar, I think, to Chris's, and kind of more in a follow-up. If one of the things we're trying to do in the disability movement is move away from the medical model, not saying that we're against prevention when that's possible, but saying that we want to look at, you know, disability as a social construction, we want to look at the ability and get rid of the dis part, you know, I very much agree with what Adrian was saying there, that it's impossible to separate the two, to say that, oh, well, once you're born and you have a disability, you know, we'll provide resources, but we want to prevent it in the first place. And I think in the last, and what I guess my clarification here is, you kind of turned it around and said, well, why not, Professor Brock, and the response to Chris's. And I guess it's that's where I want to get just a little more specific in terms of the medical model, is, you know, this idea of preventing the birth of, so we're doing that, and once a child is born, you're saying, you know, if there's a preventable disability, we often would like a, you know, we think that a parent should in some way do something, once again, the medical model, but there's no response about what about the social model, which I think then goes backwards, saying, you know, if there weren't all these barriers in our society and in our environment, disability wouldn't be, you know, as noticeable. We would be looking at people's abilities. You know, and if you're looking from that same context, and I'm, I guess, gonna ask you the same question, so why not? Why don't we go back and think of it that way, that, you know, we're thinking of, there's not all these barriers in environment, and In some ways, I guess I'd like a follow-up question with the disadvantage thing, and I'm just going to keep this one shorter. I mean, I don't think that people with disabilities in our society or in this world are the only disadvantaged people, you know, and that's a very problematic statement, I guess, in my view, that it's like, just because of that, I mean, there's so many different groups I guess we could be discussing.
Okay, Dan?
Sure. I certainly don't want to reject what you're calling the social model. That is, and I tried to make that clear in the remarks that I made. It is the case that, in my view, Adrian is right that we don't know how, we don't have the evidence to know how different things would be if we removed all the things that, on grounds of justice, in the environment that are inhospitable to people with disabilities, that we ought to remove. So. All I want to claim is that I think for serious disabilities, there would be residual significant disadvantages. Now, how big those would be, I don't know. You're certainly right that disabled persons are hardly the only disadvantaged people in the world. There are some probably that live pretty close to where we are right now. So I think that, again, it's a, I don't see an incompatibility between focusing on the inhospitable environment. I would call it an unjust environment to persons with disability, and saying that that is something that ought to be a high priority for society to remedy. So I completely agree with you there. But I do. Let's take the preconception case. Why is that different than the person who's already born? When a person is already born, let's just assume we agree that people are full moral persons after they're born. I mean, that where is the right place and what are the reasons? But let's say we agree about that. That person then has the full moral rights of any other person to something like equal concern and respect and the things that cash out that notion of equal concern and respect. Suppose I'm in the preconception circumstances and I am thinking about, well, I'm not thinking about conceiving, but my wife did at one point. One can only say there are some possible persons that might come to exist if we conceive, and those possible persons might be different. Take the example I gave you. It might be different if my wife does it now as opposed to 2 months later in that example. I don't think any possible persons, because they are only possible persons, they are not persons, they don't have a right to be born. It's not as if there are all these people lined up, all these possible persons lined up waiting to be born, and every one of them has a right to be. Possible persons are not persons. And that's why I draw a significant distinction between the claims to equal respect and concern that any of us has, whether disabled or not, and the decision that's being made before the person comes to exist.
Bob Dinnerstein.
Okay, Aloma and then Bob Dinnerstein.
This is a comment or a question for either of you, please. I work in the aging field, and in the aging field, there is a significant influence and also disconnect in the difference between the medical model approach to aging and the disability approach to disabilities in general, regardless of age. And this is sort of a little more specific. Allison started to touch on this. My question then would be, do you draw a distinction between using eugenics to control disabilities in society versus a healthcare condition of a fetus? There are huge differences, both in vitro and also after birth. I was just wondering if those made any distinctions for you.
Well, Dan, you want to start?
Okay. tell me if I have not understood your question correctly. But basically, what I want to say is, it's a mistake to think that we have to, if we accept the social model or social construction of disability, if we accept that we have to reject every aspect of the so-called medical model. I think both of those models contain part of the truth about what it is like to, and why it is like that, to have a particular disability in a particular society. So I don't think that we need to make any choice there. Those are each a part of the full explanation of what it is like to live, say, in this society with a particular disability. Now, on the eugenics thing, I don't think the goal of having healthy children is somehow morally suspect. We ask women to do a variety of things while they're pregnant, not to drink alcohol, not to do other things, in the attempt to make it the case that they will have healthy children. And most pregnant women and their spouses want their children to be healthy. So I don't think that, if that's what the eugenics movement was about, then I don't think it's so problematic. Now, the real eugenics movements that actually were, there was the Nazis, but there were eugenics movements in this country too in the early part of the 20th century and in the Scandinavian countries and a number of countries
The real eugenics movements had a lot of other things wrong with them. They did have state enforcement, which I've already said I wouldn't support. They had all kinds of stereotypes and biases, nationalist biases, ethnic biases. They had a whole bunch of features which made them clearly very seriously wrong. But I think if we just sort of tease out the idea that it's desirable to have healthy children and take that piece of the eugenics movement, then that doesn't seem to me something that we ought to condemn.
Adrian, do you have comments?
Well, I'm not sure I entirely understood Aloma's question. I don't believe that disability is equivalent in its, I don't think you can entirely say that disability and race or religion or national origin are identical. So, I mean, there is a physiologic component to impairment. Well, all right. I mean, what I'm trying to figure out is how you're tying that to the aging.
I'm not.
All right.
No. I'm using it in just making the connection between, in that population, there's a distinct difference between the medical model and the disability approach. Does that distinction hold true for genetic control?
I think the debate has been that there is a similar distinction. That is, if the only thing you know beforehand, I mean, there's a very useful article called Twice Told Tales by two bioethicists, and they show that, lo and behold, when genetic counselors and doctors talk to women about two genetically transmitted disabilities, or two prenatally diagnosable disabilities, cystic fibrosis and Down syndrome, before birth, the counselors and doctors tend to stress everything that is negative about those characteristics. Lo and behold, after birth, what they do is talk about how the child will go to school and have friends and play and grow up and this and that. And they ask, should those tales be different? Well, I think the answer is no. They should not be different. The story is the story. And I think it's noteworthy that in the before birth situation, and when I talk with genetic counselors in 2010, not in 1991 when that article was written, this is still by and large going on. When they tell the story to prospective parents, genetic counselors and doctors focus on the medical. They don't focus on the complete picture of life with disability, as though you can give a complete picture. Now, I think this is especially important because of recent legislation known as the Kennedy-Brownback Bill. Its actual name is the Prenatally and Postnatally Conditions. I can't even get it. It's a bill that says after a diagnosis prenatally or postnatally, people need to get information about the social, economic, psychological, educational, and legal ramifications of raising a child with a disability. This is a big, important law that hasn't yet been implemented in any way. This would vastly reform, I think, if it really happened, the way genetic counseling, the way medical practice, the way medical education would be done.
Robert Dinnerstein, last question.
Oh, that's a lot lot on me, given all the questions I'm sure people have. And I've got many, but I'm going to restrict. I would have restricted myself anyway. And I think, Adrian, your last point kind of leads into the question I have really for Dan. Can't you make an argument, at least with respect to conditions that, as you described it, can sometimes be very serious and sometimes less so, that there is then a moral obligation to at least be open to receive the information that Adrian is describing should be needed? Because absent that, whatever one's definition of serious is, seems to me you could be led down, even by your lights, a very improper moral path by not knowing. And of course, it's not just being open to it, it's also having available the resources, which perhaps the Kennedy Brownback will help make available.
Right. I mean, it's very interesting that that is a Kennedy Brownback bill. Those two senators were not usually on the same side of most issues, and it shows that people should, in effect, people who differ in many ways should be on the same side of that issue of providing the best information that we can to people who are in circumstances to be making those decisions. So I am 100% in support of the Kennedy-Brownback bill. I think it's the only bill that Brownback sponsored that I am in support of, but I am in support of that one.
But I think that undercuts your claim for the moral requirement of disability prevention before birth.
Well, I don't think it's... if you get full information, and let's say what you're told... I'm sorry. If you get full information and what you're told is that your child will have Tay-Sachs disease and will likely live only for a few years and will suffer substantially during that period, and there'll be very limited things that we can do to relieve that suffering, then, if you take abortion out of it, and Tay-Sachs testing is often done preconception, then it seems to me that there the condition is bad enough for the child who will have it, that I think it would be wrong to not take steps to not have a child with Tay-Sachs. I don't think there are all that many conditions that are so bad, but at the same time compatible with life, that the moral requirement comes in. But I think there are some cases where the moral requirement does look plausible, at least to me.
Doctors Brock and Ash, I appreciate very much your both coming. Providing stimulating conversation. I find an interesting proposition that I believe I disagree with both of you. And I may write about it, so we'll have an opportunity to share the information if I do. This conference has, I think, been somewhat more extended than the last that we've had. I do believe that it has worked very well to bring out numerous issues that needed to be addressed, not at perhaps as much length as they deserve, but we have had a great day and a half, and we hope to have more interesting and dramatic discussion next year. I appreciate all of your coming.